You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Oh my goodness, it's your favorite part of the week. I'm just kidding. That was very haughty of me. I can't say that. But I thank you all so much for joining. This is one of my favorite parts of the week, is to get rid of my, you know, corporate job and come into a studio and talk about some really important stuff with some even more important people. And that is absolutely happening this week as we welcome a returning guest, the smartest person I've ever spoken with, the VP of Political Studies from the Niskanen Center, my friend and yours, Jeff Cabaservice. How are you, sir? Welcome.
Hey, good to be with you, Mark.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's boy, man, a lot has happened since you were on before. What, holy cow. You did some traveling personally. I loved seeing your pictures. You went to down south in Texas, New Orleans, and I think you traveled to the land of my ancestors in Germany.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of travel. I actually am just looking at myself in your video feed, thinking I look pretty beat down.
I think we all do, buddy.
A lot going on. And, you know, it's not just the political events. Of course, you know, we're talking the night after, well, the day after that American Airlines flight collided with the helicopter and went down to the Potomac here in D.C. So thinking of all of the people who were affected by that.
Yes. And, it, you know, as more things come out, what a horrible tragedy, you know, gosh, we haven't had something like that since, 2013? And was that?
It's been a while.
It's been a while. Yeah. Yeah. It's, it is a very somber day here today too. But when you went to Germany, was that personal business? Was that, what were you?
Well, you know, part of the beauty of my job is I'm never off the job. I spend my weekends reading the books that I have to talk about during the weekdays.
Yeah.
And even when I'm traveling to somewhere like Germany, it's usually with some purpose in mind. In my most recent case, when I was in Germany, I went to the presidential building, their equivalent of the White House. Mm. I talked with a number of people about the problems that they're having, which aren't just political problems, but I guess a problem in that things don't seem to work as well as they once did in democratic societies all around the world.
What is happening?
There's a lot of dialogue about that. Well, it's a good question, but you know, more and more people on both the left and the right are thinking about this because, like I said, it is a problem of governance and delivery, government's ability to deliver on its promises, and that's what we're all struggling with.
You know, because it's interesting. I'm talking with people who are, you know, in all sorts of stages of grief and stages of what am I going to do next, and you know, a relative of mine has a child that, you know, fits into one of the categories that is being very much discriminated against. And my aunt was saying, you know, if we have to leave, if we feel more safe to leave, we don't know necessarily where to go. You know, Canada's becoming a little bit more extreme and things are happening in Germany. And like, can we dive into that? I wasn't planning on doing that, but what is happening around the world?
Well, you know, I don't think you're quite old enough to remember the 1970s,
no,
and I wasn't that old when they happened, but it was just kind of a bummer of a time for a lot of the developed countries. There was recession, and not just recession, but stagflation.
Yes.
This never-before-seen combination of stagnation plus inflation, and the cities of so many countries seemed to fall apart. You think of New York and the way that its graffiti-covered subway cars became kind of indicative of a loss of control generally. You saw hitherto unseen levels of crime, drug addiction, disorder. And in some ways, it feels like parts of the 1970s are coming back to us, and we're as much of a loss at how to deal with that as people were back then. But I don't think, you know, any one society has the answer, and at best, we're all going to be trying to work toward different parts of the solution. But, you know, clearly what's one very different element from then and now is, well, the presence of social media, for one thing. but also the way that social media, in ways we don't fully understand, has helped to drive a significant inflow of immigration from what used to be called the less developed world into the developed countries. And the way that that puts those societies under stress at a time when they already can't maintain their social welfare systems. It's causing problems and giving rise to populism all around the globe.
Yeah, I mean, it is fascinating how sometimes, you know, once bastions of, you know, moderate thought like Canada, you know, or France is now, you know, kind of seeping into the Trumpiness, I guess. You know what I mean? It's a wild time to be a VP of political studies, I think.
it's a wild time to be thinking about politics generally.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've seen this at work in our politics here, because in many ways, you know, the Democrats lost support all across the board in the last election. Mm-hmm. And they particularly lost a lot of support from within the big cities themselves.
Working class people. Yes.
Working class people, minorities,
yes. Yeah.
You know, in a way that just hadn't been seen. And, you know, again, the feeling on the part of those voters who have been talking to pollsters and so on is just that the Democrats are no longer able to deliver in a way that they once were. And not just that they're not able to deliver, but they don't seem to understand that they're not delivering, and they don't seem to care about issues like inflation and public disorder and the stresses caused by immigration.
Yeah, it is interesting how, you know, Republicans used to be the party of the filthy elite, you know, and the rich and all of that. And now that has completely flipped.
Yeah.
You know, unions, UAW? And some of, you know, it has completely gone to the right, who has historically been very anti-union, very, you know, I mean,
there's definitely some people in like the national conservative circles who will talk about how the right needs to embrace unions.
Yeah.
I think that comes unnaturally to Republicans. They're never really going to fully get there. But, you know, one thing that was fascinating to me about what happened last year was that Joe Biden gave the Teamsters the biggest bribe in a way that any presidential administration has ever done with a union, you know, bailing out their pension fund to the tune of $80 billion. Yeah. And the Teamsters didn't even endorse him. It's just astonishing.
Right. Yeah, that was, that is wild. And, you know, and to kind of see where, never in a million years would I have thought that what happened would have happened. But then, I hate going down this road. I do, but I blame the Atlantic because they published an article that said, Atlantic said how Hitler destroyed or dismantled democracy in 53 days. Well, I think, what do they say? 1 month, 3 weeks, 2 days, 8 hours, and 40 minutes to be precise. I don't know if you read that article, but it was fascinating. You probably know the history better than just about anybody. But I hate saying this because it's that whole, Trumpers are Nazis and all of that. And it's not a way to build a bridge. It's not a way to get people out of that. But when I read that, the parallels were frightening.
Yeah. Germany in the 1930s is not quite the same as America
No.
in 2025. But having said that, I read a piece by David French recently where he was talking about the Nazi jurist Carl Schmitt, who, you know, is not anyone that most Americans ever will have heard of. And did I mention, by the way, he's a Nazi, you know? So his ideas are not the ones that we're talking about. But the reason that he's become influential among people who think about these things in terms of political philosophy is that his principal distinction in politics is the friend-enemy distinction. And politics should be about rewarding your friends, in his view, and punishing your enemies. And ultimately, that really means exterminating your enemies. And if you in America in 2025, you know, are thinking about politics and you've never heard of Carl Schmitt, but you're thinking about the other side as your enemies, and maybe even that something needs to be done to remove them from public life and maybe the planet altogether, then you have wandered into Nazi terrain without knowing it and without knowing anything about the whole rest of the Nazi philosophy and regalia and apparatus. I mean, so in this sense, I am much less concerned by Elon Musk giving a Nazi salute than I am by people in the Republican Party talking seriously about the Democratic Party as their enemy.
Right. And The question that I had too is, you know, and I understand that, you know, the German Republic was very, very young. They didn't have the safeguards that we have here. So in all reality, I don't think that, you know, that's not going to happen to us. I don't believe. But like you say, the parallels were really stark in this article. You know, I didn't realize that he talked about getting rid of the parliamentarian swamp, and then he pardoned people that were criminals as well, and you know, they were seen as heroes. They you know, talked about mass deportations that are poisoning the blood. I mean, like the things that were talked about. We're not going to seep into Nazism, but holy cow, that thinking is very dangerous and can lead to very dangerous things. Are people overreacting with that?
Well, you know, no one wants to hear about my trips, but I was in Munich, Germany.
I absolutely want to hear about that. Yes.
I was blessed. You know, I mean, everyone should go to Oktoberfest at least once, as long as you're fairly comfortable with large crowds in which people are drinking enormous quantities of beer.
How was it?
That was great. But, you know, Munich is actually where the Nazi movement got its start. And, you know, in some sense, that was always the Vatican of the Nazi movement, even though it's a city which feels more Italian, I think, than most other cities in Germany. It has a long tradition of artistic innovation and strong culture. But there always was something even in that, you know, 19th century Munich culture that was looking for a strong man to bring about a solution to disorder and reassert Germany's proper place in the world. And that brew of nationalism and discontent with a government that can't solve problems and looking for someone who can cut through all of the obstacles to bring that solution, those are going to be present in any society. And the question is, what specific amount of circumstances might bring them to the surface as something dangerous? And in that sense, I recommend that everybody who does go to Munich, you know, don't just go to Oktoberfest, don't just go for the museums. Also have a look at the NS Documentation Center, which is built on the site of the Brown House, which was the Nazi headquarters in Munich. And they have an amazing display of how the society fell to the Nazis, step by step, really, and how it can happen elsewhere. And it's always worth every society thinking about the dangers that could be in store from allowing politics to become existential combat.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I think we're heading to break here in just a moment. That's one of the things that is troubling for me is, okay, we have people that are moderate headed, and how do we get back to that? And we're going to continue this discussion here with Jeff Cabaservice from the Niskanen Center here right after this.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back. Wrestle Revolution, you got me, Mark Becker. We've got our dear friend Jeff Cabaservice from the Niskanen Center. If you don't know who the Niskanen Center is, shame on you. But for a refresher course, they are a leading Washington, D.C. think tank policy center. They advocate for things like immigration reform, environmentalism, civil liberties. They're a leader in finding pragmatic and bipartisan solutions. So they are definitely people that we need to pay attention to, respect, listen to, because they put a lot of thought into what they do. We were talking about on the other side, you know, Munich and how that happened, how it was allowed to happen. And I think there's parallels a little bit, because I remember when I was in the Republican Party and we had people that were really common sense, that were forward thinkers. You know, I talk about old rising stars of like Nancy Mace and Elise Stefanik and at one point Ron Johnson, and some of these people that really had common sense-ish, moderate-ish solutions and had a desire to work with people across the aisle.
Yeah.
They're gone.
It used to be, you know, I wrote a history of the moderate faction of the Republican Party from its origins back in the 1850s through, well, what at that point was the Tea Party movement. And, you know, there haven't been moderates in the Republican Party for a while, but there have been a number of people who are conservative but serious about governing. They take seriously the obligation to actually govern in the interest of the entire United States, not just their district, states, or supporters. And, you know, I actually worked for a Republican organization back in 2015, 2016, where, you know, for example, they were actually very serious about finding breakthrough cures at a higher rate than had happened so far, about getting them through the FDA approval process more quickly, and actually bolstering funding to the National Institutes of Health and the kind of basic research that leads to those breakthroughs that can allow us to cure cancer. And so in that sense, you felt great about working for the Republican Party. They were a responsible governing party, going about the process of governing in a different way than the Democrats would, obviously, but able to collaborate with Democrats and find common ground solutions. And unfortunately, there's just a lot less of that now in Washington, to put it mildly.
Yes. Yeah, there sure is. Last time you were here, you talked about chaos is Trump's friend. I believe that was that was a quote you said. And, you know, we're inching ever closer to midnight. I think we're at like 89 seconds now is what the doomsday clock is at. And I can't, I mean, this last week and a half has been something that it was a blur, a whirlwind. And we talked about last week with our political director here at Civic Media, Dan Schaefer. We talked about how it's like this wall of sound that just comes at you. And last time around, Trump was more interested in things like saber rattling. But now he has people that it's more action based. You know, chaos is Trump's friend. Boy, were you right about that.
Just think about that. 89 seconds. That's not even the length of a Ramones song.
Right. That's a good, I like that. That's good.
Well, look, you know, we're talking here in the first 2 weeks of Trump 2, right? And already it's very clear that it's very different from Trump 1. You know, Trump won the first time he came into office in 2017. He had no idea what he was doing.
Yeah.
He hadn't expected to win. He took a long time getting positions filled at the different departments and agencies. And he ultimately had to rely on people who had served in previous Republican administrations. So the Reagan and Bush people, basically, who were not on board with Trumpism and
right.
who in some ways thwarted his worst impulses. It's a very different picture this time around. Trump has purged the Republican Party of previous non-believers in that sense, even if people who have been Republican administrators or members of Congress secretly are Reaganites in their heart, they're going to pretend that they believe in Trump. And so what we're seeing now is both some of the chaos of the first Trump administration, but also a considerably more focused attempt to take over the government in a way that Trump 1 was not capable of. So, you know, on the one hand, we're seeing Project 2025 being put into action. And I don't just mean all of the different policy proposals that were in the big, 20-pound book mandate for leadership.
No one knew what it was, you know?
Well, you know, very few people had the patience to go through the whole thing.
Even the authors were like, huh, what is that?
Yeah. But, you know, there were three other components of Project 2025. People tend to forget this. One of them was an attempt to create a conservative LinkedIn. A sort of big database of people who had been vetted. Their social media had been looked into. There hadn't been any disagreement of Trump in their past. It was pretty likely that they would be Trump vassals in this administration. And those people are being put into administrative positions as quickly as can be managed. There also was a kind of training module about how to do the basics of governing. But then there was also a kind of 180-day action plan complete with a number of pre-executed executive orders that could be put in place on day one of the Trump administration. And we've seen those going directly from, I think, the brain of Russ Vought and the pen of Russ Vought to Trump's desk where he can sign it. And in that sense, it's been a much more disciplined attack on uprooting the Biden administration's accomplishments, turning government to Trump's vassal in a way. And again, a certain amount of competence there, like being able even to shut down the immigration app that immigrants to this country were using to get appointments to enter within an hour of Trump taking office. And yet at the same time, we've also seen chaos already. in the form of the OMB freeze on federal spending, which was then unfrozen, or has it been frozen again? Right. You know, OMB wasn't talking to the White House or going to approve for their to them for their approval before it sent out this memo, causing chaos around the world. So it's this very distinctive Trumpian mixture of focused revenge with a certain degree of competence plus massive incompetence. And I think that's what we're going to be seeing for as long as this administration lasts.
Right. And we're talking with Jeff Cabaservis from the Niskanen Center. What freedoms are being eroded here? What are we seeing in terms of that?
You know, I think it's early days yet to say what freedoms are being eroded, because probably some that we're not even paying attention to are being eroded, and maybe some things that we're worried about are not going to prove out. I think what we are seeing is an attempt by the Trump people to break down the norms that have governed American politics and society throughout most of our history, and in particular to augment the power of the executive at the expense of Congress. And what we're really waiting to see with considerable trepidation is whether the Trump administration is going to take on the judiciary, whether some of these cases that are going that have already been launched against Trump's actions, including doing away with birthright citizenship, are going to make their way to the Supreme Court, how the Supreme Court will rule, and then if the Trump administration will abide by the rulings of the Supreme Court. If the Trump administration decides that it will do what J.D. Vance counseled them to do, supposedly act as Andrew Jackson said, the Supreme Court has issued its decision, now let them enforce it, right, then we will have crossed over into something much closer to authoritarianism than anything we've seen before.
Well, I think, you know, if you know anything about Trump, his affinity to Andrew Jackson, I bet you that played right into that ego that he has. I want to drill in on that again. We're up against a break, but I want to talk about, you know, what are we looking at in terms of future for the country, for the party? Is there a party that is going to, you know, come out of this? Because one of some of the guests that we've had have talked about, you know, we had Michael Steele, and he said, oh, well, the Republican Party is no more. He was the chairman of the darn thing. And I love Michael. I think he's a wonderful man. He's a friend, and he's brilliant. And if that guy's saying it, holy cow, are we, it's going to be some crazy time. So we'll be right back here with Jeff Cabaservis on the Rational Revolution. When the DJ spins this one, that's a good song. We've got Jeff Cabaservis from the Niskanen Center. He's the VP of Political Studies. Smartest dude in the room. And I want to talk about, you know, what's the game plan here? I don't know if, you know, because I've never stepped inside of a think tank or a policy center. Like, do you guys like war game this stuff? It's like, okay, well, if this happens, this happens. Does anyone run through some of those scenarios?
Let me first of all hasten to add that I would never describe myself as the smartest guy in the room.
He said that last time. I'm sticking with that.
it can only bring disaster upon your head.
You're humble.
You know, you mentioned Michael Steele. A lot of what think tank world, frankly, is about is connecting people who have different perspectives and trying to hear them out. Although it's a think tank by label, in a lot of ways, it's a listening tank. And you're trying to hear people from a lot of different perspectives and then think about what hasn't been said or hasn't been noticed enough in the popular discourse, in the political discourse. And, you know, the Niskanen Center, you were very kind to give a description of what it is. You know, it's always been hard to describe. It's not exactly a center-right think tank. It's not exactly a post-libertarian think tank, but it has elements of those in its DNA. But I would largely say that we are engaged in trying to talk to members on both sides of the aisle in Congress and find the people who are serious about addressing a particular issue and then do what we can to help them out, whether they're Republican or Democrat. So, again, I'm not sure that bipartisan is the right word for what we do, but we are trying to make things better in our own way. But I think, you know, there's also a place in think tank world for thinking big about, like I said, the problems that are facing all of society and how we got to where we are. And that's why I'm very grateful as a historian, you know, from a largely academic background, to be able to hold down a job here. Because I do talk to a lot of people who are trying to think, how did the Republican Party change so much from what it was in the 1950s under Eisenhower, or even in the 1980s, 90s under Reagan and Bush, or even in the 2000s under George W. Bush, to Donald Trump's populism? How did this happen? And, you know, I don't think we have answers, and I don't know that we have, you know, the simple solution to how we get out of this, but we at least have angles on what has happened.
Yeah, that's why I love the Niskanen Center, because it's kind of like my motto here for the show is, it's not left versus right, it's right versus wrong. And I think what's cool about what you guys do is that that's what you do. You find the people that want to do the most good, and you help them do it, which is an admirable thing. And we do need more of that. But, you know, what are people seeing is like, what's going to happen in 2 years? I mean, we don't necessarily know, you know, what policies or all of that, but like, is there a Republican Party in the future? If there is, what happens to the people that did want, you know, Tom Tillis, he did want to work, he did want to do something, but now, you know, is going into that populism and the Trumpism, and because it plays well.
Well, you know, for complicated reasons, America seems to be stuck with a two-party system. Even though, you know, in any other system, we would probably have multiple parties contending because, you know, the moderate Republicans I wrote about always had a fairly uneasy coexistence with more conservative Republicans. and Trump's populism is something different even from that. And if you go back in American history to look for predecessors to Trump, yes, you find it in the Republican Party in figures like Joe McCarthy, but also in the Democratic Party in figures like George Wallace. And populism has a long and fairly bipartisan strain in American history going all the way back to the 19th century. And, you know, American society, even when it has had periods of apparent consensus, has always had a lot of stress points within it. We're a very divided society, partly because we're just such a big society. But, you know, I think what we have seen in recent times is that Republicans who didn't like Trump nonetheless knew that he really had a hold on a large part of the Republican base, and he could walk at any moment. And the fear of letting Trump walk away with his supporters and maybe try to start a third party is what kept Republicans on board even after January 6th and ultimately allowed him to regain power. And, you know, the Democrats have their own problems with their more extreme factions and their seeming inability to repudiate them and move toward a more popular position. I saw actually that Quinnipiac came out with a poll showing that Democrats are more unpopular now with a 57% disapproval rating than they have been at any point since that poll started being taken back in the early 2000s. So, you know, they've got a brand problem to overcome, and yet it's very difficult to do that without splitting the party.
Well, because, you know, if you are a conservative, if you are someone who, you know, does dwell in the middle, there is no place for you on the right. There is no, if you are someone that says, I cannot get behind that Trumpism, I cannot do it. Really, it's, you're a blue dog or you're nobody, you know?
Well, it's tough, but it's even more complicated than that. So let me actually do a little bit of devil's advocacy.
Okay? I love it.
You know, one of our senior fellows is Jennifer Palka, who I think is just a brilliant person and has written one of the best books about the work of government. It's called Recoding America. I highly recommend to one and all. And, you know, she is a significant person in today's dialogue because she started the U.S. Digital Service, which has now been taken over by Doge. okay. And this is Elon Musk's attempt to do something with the government. What it is isn't quite clear. And, you know, Jen is a reformer, and she understands that government is important, indeed essential, to actually carrying out life for our citizenry. And yet the Democratic Party has been 100% the obstacle of reform. And almost everything that people have proposed to make government more efficient, more effective, to get it online, has been opposed by people from within the bureaucracy and the ranks of the Democratic Party. And in fact, the usual response is to any kind of reform proposal, that's illegal. Is it illegal? No, it almost never is. But, you know, people believe it and they're just against change, period. Yeah. And it's tough because when you actually talk about, for example, how the civil service could be much more effective if it had the ability to hire talented people quickly and fire non-performers, that has been an absolute non-starter for Democrats. And, you know, this kind of immovable object invites irresistible force in the form of Trumpism. And, you know, Jen is, I think, taking a wait-and-see attitude towards Doge. But, you know, it is entirely possible that there could be some positive impact there, because Elon Musk is like Trump in lacking any kind of shamelessness. And when people tell him that the thing he wants to do is illegal, he's not going to just take that as an answer. And already he has empowered Doge to do things that the U.S. Digital Service could not do in terms of just getting information from agencies and departments and making them more efficient. And there's a way in which that could turn out to be a positive project. But the problem with Trumpism generally is it takes dynamite to a structure when what you really want to do is renovate it. And, you know, dynamiting the institutions is no more of a solution than absolutely defending them in their decline and dysfunction. So that's the sense, I think, in which we feel like we don't have a party. Both parties are just too set into an anti-establishment or reflexively pro-establishment mindset to actually make any progress.
Yeah, I think you're spot on with that. It is interesting that, and I think that's one of the frustrations with some of the people that are a little bit on the center side, is that Trump has such an opportunity to do so many good things that have been needed to be done for so long. Yeah. He's just such a terrible person, and such, you know, the ideas are, and the things that he says is rooted in racism, misogyny, you know, anti-LGBT, like a really dark place. But he's someone that could have positive impacts, but it's not really that way, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's a real danger on the right of trying to think Trump is the better person than right. he really demonstrates himself to be. But there's no doubt that he has an opportunity. And, you know, we'll see if he makes the most of it. But my suspicion is he will make the worst of it.
So if you are a moderate, are you homeless? Here's, that's Lincoln Project people or you know, politically homeless. I mean, that's a phrase that's said quite often.
You know, I've been thinking about the whole Never Trump movement. And I think one of the flaws of the Never Trump movement can be self-pity and precisely this belief that we're homeless, you know, we're doomed to scrape in the garbage cans from the comfort of our home out in Fauquier County, Virginia, right?
Yeah.
You know, typically the Never Trump person is someone who is very attuned to a particular segment of the American population, which is educated people, often living in fairly affluent suburbs, who hold down professional and managerial jobs, who have been so turned off by Trump and the Republicans that they've gone over to the Democrats. But they don't necessarily feel at home among the Democrats either. The Democrats have had a lot of their own excesses, which were very evident during the Biden years. So I would actually fault the Never Trump people for not trying to actually do more politically among that segment. You know, my friend Steve Tellis takes things a little bit farther, but he has said that the Never Trump Republicans could have made a lot more of themselves if they had even won one county election in some of these places and tried to have an actual political base from which to operate. And I think that is one answer. But let me also just, you know, this question about homelessness. I don't feel homelessness in the sense that I feel that I can have dialogues with a lot of people on both sides of the aisle here in Washington. And the thing that's concerning increasing numbers of people is the nature of our competition with China. And I suppose you saw the news about DeepSeek.
AI, oh my God,
program that came out, which apparently the Chinese have done something which is as powerful as most of the things coming out of California and yet is just fractionally
cost. Yeah, it's like $5 million versus billions and billions.
Yeah. And, you know, Mark Andreessen may be exaggerating when he says that this is like another Sputnik moment, but we might look back on it that way. And I think that what we might see in the Trump administration, if you're looking for a sort of gleam of hope, is that there will be Republicans and Democrats who take the nature of our competition with China sufficiently seriously that they'll actually be willing to team up and make positive progress. It probably isn't going to be the sort of thing that makes big headlines. But it might well be the sort of thing that delivers more support to our scientific and technological operations and actually allows higher education to do what it's best at. And like I said, you might see more covert support for that from both sides of the aisle than you would expect.
I think that would be a wonderful thing. And I think that would also require people that are in the administration to be someone that supports things like higher education you know, giving schools the tools that they need to educate people in the way that they, that can make them successful. And, you know, that's, that would be something that I think we would need as well.
Yeah. But, you know, will we find moderation is the question.
Right.
And, you know, it seems that the dynamic is that the left comes out with the 1619 Project, which says that the whole American experience and all of our ideals are rooted in slavery.
Yeah.
And that's not something that the American people likes. And then no. The Republicans come out with the 1776 Commission, which essentially whitewashes American history and said, you know, that everyone in American history has always been good and noble, except for those evil Democrats and progressives who brought in bureaucracy and taxation. And people just, they want something somewhere in the middle of that, and they're not getting what they're looking for.
So that's and that's kind of the question that I have, you know, of you is if there is someone that is in the middle, if there is someone that, you know, wants to, that's going to be running for Senate or state office or whatever, and they say, you know, I don't believe that the government should overtax people. I believe that people should have their freedoms enshrined in the Constitution. Those are unalienable. Those are ours. And that is uniquely American. And I believe that we should do what's right and fight for what is right and work with people. What side is that? They would run as an R or a D. I think, you know, I know the answer to that. Because
go ahead.
Well, because of my experience with the Republican Party, that's where I was. And when I saw someone that was uniquely dangerous and uniquely positioned and uniquely not giving a flying F about where we are, you had to align with that guy or you're not in the party.
You know, I think things are tougher for the Republicans. The kind of person you're describing who actually does want to speak to the whole population and solve problems is going to have to face the difficulty that if they enter as a Republican, they're more or less obligated to acknowledge that Trump was the real winner of the 2020 election. So they have to bend the knee to a lie. And that is something that is almost immediately disqualifying for someone who
100%.
Wants to actually be a moral, honest operative in search of truth and progress. So that's a problem.
We have 10 seconds left. So
You know, the problem that we face on both sides is that to win the nomination, you have to get through the primary, and the primary only attacks a relatively small audience of the most committed ideologues, and that's tough for both parties.
Right. Jeff Cabaservice, we could keep this going for another hour. I thank you so very much for your time. I know it's very precious, and thank you for your friendship, and I appreciate everything.
We'll see you back. Always to talk to you, Mark.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.
We'll see you back on the Rational Revolution right after this.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
We sang every song that Javi knew. Freedom is just another word for...
If I was Chris Alfheim, I would be singing my heart out. Oh, I hope she's doing well, and we send our best to her. She's a previous host of this, and she's that's her song, so we try to do that and play it and wish her well. So my thanks to Jeff Cabaservice. And if you are a listener of this show and you kind of care about what's happening and want, you know, moderation and want, you know, what's not what's left, what's right, but what's right versus what's wrong, their work is really, really good. And it's awesome because if you do any research on who they have employed at the Niskanen Center, it is people from all over the place, and you'll recognize some names. You might not recognize Jeff's other than from this show, but I mean, he's written books. You should buy his book. And I mean, these guys are incredibly, you know, looked at for opinions when it comes to really, really tough issues. These guys, they're important. And, I very grateful for his time and his friendship, and he's a good dude. And absolutely, he is the smartest person in the room. So don't let his humbleness fool you. But he's really a wonderful man. I wasn't sure what I was going to talk about here in this last segment, but I figured it out on Wednesday morning when I was watching Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s hearing to be the esteemed Secretary of our Health and Human Services. And I got to say, I don't think we could pick someone as unqualified to sit in that chair as him. But I want to give some help because there's so often that people will say, you know, what can I do? How can I, you know, get to a point where I'm impacting change. I have no platform. I don't know what to do. Well, here's what you can do. I want to tell you how to recognize some things and how to push someone away from going into those rabbit holes. And this is how they get there, you know, where the conspiracies and all these things. And so when someone this is like their gateway drug, right? And it's exactly what happened at Robert F. Kennedy's hearing. And it was in a conversation that he had with Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee. And so often when people get to the point where they're in this dangerous, you know, world and everything is spinning around them and it's this chaos and it starts with, hey, let's agree to disagree on, you know, X, Y, Z, and this is what it is. Robert F. Kennedy was talking to Marsha Blackburn about it. Have you ever noticed that the kids these days, they're on ADHD medication or, you know, so many people have a food allergy now and they have depression and everything. That is how they do it. That is how people get sucked into these rabbit holes at like warp speed. People like RFK Jr., Marsha Blackburn, people like my old pal, Senator Ronnie Johnson, they'll spew some random thought about, hey, you know, boy, that's strange. Or a question like, hey, yeah, don't you find it weird how blah? And then they just leave it at that. They just put it out there. And then you're guided to this like cliff that you just go down like the roaring tide of Niagara Falls, and then you're in it before you even could blink. And the truth is, I was one of those kids. I was a kid that couldn't pay attention, who needed some help. I'm an adult that still takes some medication to keep my spaghetti bowl of a mind focused. Sometimes it doesn't work very well. But hey, you know, that is what it is. And our son as well, he's going to, he inherited that little trait from his old man. But the problem is these people never, they take these things and they never take into consideration the humanity of what their wild accusations are spewing. As Marsha Blackburn, you know, she's never thought that as society grows, we grow into our understanding. And we grow into our understanding of some of these conditions that people do have. And we grow into our knowledge of how to help. And that's where we all come in. When people are going into these rabbit holes, we can talk to them about, hey, you know what? Maybe, as Robert F. Kennedy said, this is what he said in that hearing. He said, We have people that have ADHD and they have all these medications and our children are medicated and what they don't need is medication, but what they need is counseling. They need counseling. This dude is going to be in charge of like the FDA or whatever, you know, the policy making of the biggest health organization in the world. And we have modern medication and ways to help. And he says, well, they don't need that. They need counseling. This is like in the 90s where, hey, people, we can stop the gay epidemic. All we need to do is pray to God. Well, that didn't work. And neither will this. We have miracles of modern medicine that can help relieve children of suffering. And instead, we say they need counseling. And then we can talk about the pressures and the stress that children are under. At 5 years old, our children are expected to go to pre-K. They're expected to go there. And if they go to kindergarten, they're going to be behind if they didn't go to that pre-K. And then in first grade, they're supposed to write a short freaking essay. And they get a half hour recess. And you're in school for 7 hours. Can you imagine how hard that is on the kids? You wonder why they're so stressed. You know, when I was a child, I never had the pressure of knowing that every single person in my class has a high definition camera in their pocket and they can take a video. And every slip, every mistake, anything that you would do 30 minutes later is shared with the entire school. Can you imagine that stress? Can you imagine that stress? You know, and that these are the things that where we come in is when someone says, hey, you know, boy, isn't it weird how people that, you know, all of a sudden everyone's on ADHD medication? What we do is we stand up and say, no, it's not weird at all. We found a thing that can help kids. We found a thing that can help adults. And it's a responsible thing to do to say, hey, if this is going to help you, let's help you. That is what we have to do. And my point is that in all this chaos, please, please, please don't forget to honor other people's dignity. Have the empathy to understand what it is they are dealing with and bring decency back to our society and our politics, even if elected officials won't. Be that leader and stop people before they get into those rabbit holes with facts, with truth, and with decency. We'll see you next week here on The Rational Revolution. My thanks to Jeff Cabaservis, Niskanen Center, producer Amanda, and everyone here at Civic Media. We'll see you next week.
How many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? Yes, and how many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? Yes, and how many deaths will it take till he knows?
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.